Do you have a dark curiosity? Heart Starts Pounding, Horrors, Hauntings, and Mysteries is a weekly podcast hosted by me, Kaylin Moore. Check out Heart Starts Pounding on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, folks, 810 in the Twin Cities, 83 degrees. Time now for one of my favorite guests, Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. How are you?
I'm doing great, but I'm worried. There's nothing to talk about tonight.
We were chatting, actually, folks, in the break. I was chatting with Professor Schultz in the break about just, once again, just head-spinning developments in the world of politics at the national level. And the headlines across the country, are they talking about the health care, the Cassidy, Graham Cassidy bill? Are they talking about the showdown with North Korea? All enormous stories. No, it is the president's tweets and responses involving Steph Curry of the Golden State Warriors, the superstar, and another superstar, LeBron James. What do you make of this?
Well, my first words, I want to just use the word bizarre right off the bat. But you know, what's, you know, for anybody who wants to think sports and politics aren't connected, there's a long history of it. You know, we know that. And this is what we're looking at here, is just an unusual relationship between sports and politics right now, which I think goes back what the Colin Kaepernick about kneeling, during
the national anthem.
During national anthem, Trump not liking the idea and saying that it's disrespect. It's Steph Curry coming to his defense as well as other athletes, and then it's Trump, you know, criticizing, withdrawing the invitation to the Golden State Warriors to the White House. LeBron James chiming in. I mean, it's like a soap opera, you know. But if I can sort of sort out sort of one thought here, is that, you know, on one level, you know, Trump is breaking the mold in another way. Usually presidents don't comment on things such as when athletes do things like, you know, express their First Amendment free speech rights, or they engage in making statements like this. And Trump feels like he needs to sort of, you know, interject himself into this, and then does something even further, which is what? Is to uninvite a team to the White House, which is pretty much always a pro forma thing that they do.
Right. And you know, it's interesting because I guess part of what precipitated this, although Trump had been talking about Colin Kaepernick and speech saying, you know, that NFL owners should just fire any players that take a knee, which is probably only going to result in more people taking a knee. But, you know, mm-hmm. that got a lot of applause at a speech he gave. Steph Curry was asked about a trip to the White House at a news conference, and he said, well, if I had to vote, I would vote against it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when the president, apparently seeing that comment, tweeted that, you know, it's an honor to come to the White House and Steph Curry's not invited.
Right.
Even though Steph Curry had signaled that you probably wouldn't come anyway. Mm-hmm. And then LeBron James tweets, you bum, at the president, and basically says Steph Curry said he wasn't going. You can't disinvite him. So it's just – but these tweets have gotten hundreds of thousands of retweets.
Mm-hmm.
It's and to think that this is sort of what everybody's focusing on right now when there are all these other issues at stake.
Right, because on one level, this doesn't amount to a hill of beans in the world, you know, on one level here. You know, this is, you know, but you're right. You know, we were during the off the air, I was saying to you, this is probably lighting up the social media, and it exactly is. And again, sort of put it in a little bit of a perspective here on one level, it's sort of Trump, you know, on one level taking the cultural war, which for many, many years, for many Republicans, but certainly not all, which has been directed against Hollywood actors and actresses, and just Hollywood in general. And now this kind of cultural war, you know, is moving into the area of politics. And this is going to be really fascinating to watch, because I think Trump also had a tweet today, too, if I remember correctly, in terms of the NFL and the work that it's taking in terms of trying to prevent, was it concussions and stuff like that?
I didn't see that one. I know that the NFL has responded. I mean, I can look at his Twitter feed right now, because there have been so many. But the NFL responded with a sharp critique of the president. So,
mm-hmm. What I'm getting at here is in a variety of different ways, you know, if we think of football as sort of being, you know, one of the quintessential American sports, I mean, it's really sort of laced with patriotism. You know, yeah, I mean, I ask my students at one point, undergraduates, is there, what's one event that defines the United States? And they say Super Bowl Sunday, you know, that it sort of captures everything about the United States. And so now we're having football, we're having sports become yet a new cultural divide in the United States. And that's probably not good for professional sports in terms of the fact that we're now going to have what? Probably, I'm going to say red and blue teams. We're going to have divides in that area, and we're divides in that area in the same way that we're seeing other kind of divides in our culture. And again, I just don't think this is good because we're just seeing absolutely everything in our society divide us.
Right. The tweet he put out about the NFL was Roger Goodell. The NFL just put out a statement trying to justify the total disrespect certain players show to our country. Tell them to stand. I can also say that his tweets are just, as you look at the tweets, the number of retweets is just actually rolling. I'd never really kind of looked at it that way. And going up, that has, it just went from 66.9 thousand tweets, which is obviously a considerable amount. Mm-hmm. But it's, I think amongst his base, though, mm-hmm. I think that these moves probably are going to be popular.
Oh, it is. That's exactly the issue here. It's about a divide here. It's a divide between part of his base, you know, and this kind of reminds me back to the 1960s, early 1970s. What was that slogan among some? My country, love it or leave it, or something like that. There's this sense in which patriotism has been defined as, I think now, you stand for the Star Spangled Banner, that it's not appropriate to sort of, you know, express, you know, dissent, even though I think for many of us, dissent is as much a part of American culture as it is, as patriotic as it is saluting the flag. And so this just seems to me, again, just opening up old wounds and new wounds that just are not going to be good for NFL. And I feel sorry for the NFL. I feel sorry for all the sports because they're now going to have to figure out how to extract themselves out of this, and I don't think they can. And then secondarily, I want to say, going back to it, is that normally presidents don't get themselves enmeshed in these type of cultural battles, especially, you know, with sports, you know, at this level domestically. They just sort of say, okay, if this is the choice of Kaepernick to do what he wants to do, fine. If Curry wants to do that, it's fine. But Trump seems to take everything absolutely personally, and it has found, at least among his base, some of this works very well. But it certainly, I think, doesn't do much in terms of expanding his base or helping his influence in terms of working with Congress, working with Democrats, working with lots of different people.
Right. And, you know, Kaepernick is one issue because I think he is very polarizing. Steph Curry is enormously popular.
Yes.
I mean, I think he's probably one of the most popular NBA players or professional athletes in the country, mm-hmm. not the world. So it'll be interesting to see how far that goes. We do have to take a break. I do want to ask you about the federal health care situation, and also later on, a lot going on in the state of Minnesota with the breakdown of mediation, and also a healthcare crisis that I talked to you about, this waiver that the president has not granted, or the Trump administration has not granted, drastic cuts to MinCare. This is all going to happen very, very quickly, or could happen very, very quickly. So a lot to talk about. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about John McCain, and we'll talk about what looks like maybe the end of this final effort, or this additional effort, to repeal and replace Obamacare, this Graham-Cassidy bill. Keep it here, News Radio 830. It is 8:21 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with Professor David Schultz. We do want to get to some state issues. We'll probably get those in our next half hour with the mediation collapsing between the governor and also legislative leaders, as well as a healthcare crisis here, a standoff with the White House that could lead to higher premiums for individuals who are buying on the individual market, and also could lead to severe cuts in a program that helps 100,000 low-income Minnesotans. But let's talk about this healthcare bill, this Graham bill, Lindsey Graham bill. This is a bill that looks like it's probably going to go down to defeat because of John McCain.
Right. And this would be the second time that John McCain has killed in the last few months, efforts for the Trump administration and the Senate to try to repeal Obamacare and replace it or just repeal it. And he did it this time claiming and saying that he doesn't like the process. Didn't necessarily say he disagreed with the bill, although that's open, but he said that any kind of change has to be bipartisan and is insisting that the bill go through its normal process, which means committee hearings, votes, amendments, and so forth. And so he's standing pretty firm. We already know that Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul, has said that he's going to vote against it. They can only take one more person. At this point, if these were the only two people who voted against it and all the other Republicans and others voted for it in favor, who's expected to vote, could vote for it in favor, it would be 50-50. Vice President cast the tying vote. But we suspect that Susan Collins from Maine and Lisa Murkowski from Alaska may very well vote against it, but it's only going to take one of them. And it's looking pretty likely that at least one of them and maybe a couple of other senators may vote against it, which means that one of the big promises of Trump and of the Republicans to repeal Obamacare may very well die yet again.
Right. And so they basically need to get – they need to have 50 vote right. Yes. 50? Or actually, I guess – yeah, I guess they need to have 50, don't they?
They need to have 50.
Yes, and then Pence can break the tie.
That's right. And again, right now it looks like they're at exactly 50 right now. And again, as I was mentioning, it's likely that Susan Collins will vote against it, which will be one Republican defector. And remember, Lisa Murkowski is not a Republican; is an independent. She could very well vote against it. But I've also heard rumors of a couple of other Republicans who might consider voting against it too. But I think it's pretty likely that some of those Republicans will be taking their cues from John McCain and not supporting it. So I think the last that I heard, I think the vote is scheduled for, what, Tuesday or Wednesday this week, if in fact they're going to bring it to a vote. And I could see Mitch McConnell deciding not to bring it up to a vote because I don't think he wants to suffer another defeat at this point in the same way that he had a pretty embarrassing defeat for him several months ago.
The two sponsors of this bill are Senator Bill Cassidy and Lindsey Graham. Bill Cassidy from Louisiana, Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. There's actually a debate scheduled tomorrow night. It was announced sort of late, I think Thursday, that Amy Klobuchar and Bernie Sanders are going to debate Senators Cassidy and Graham live on CNN tomorrow. I think the edge on this debate has been taken off somewhat by John McCain announcing he's going to vote against it because the math, as you were just saying, makes it appear that this ain't going to work. But when it was announced on Thursday, McCain had not yet said how he was going to vote. Lindsey Graham actually is his best friend in the Senate. So there was some speculation that Graham could, you know, kind of drag McCain along. What do you think of this debate and the fact that Amy Klobuchar is going to be standing up there with Bernie Sanders, debating in a primetime audience, against these two authors of this bill?
This is really fascinating. You know, we could first say it's just a debate. It's just Bernie Sanders and Amy Klobuchar who are representing, you know, independent and representing the Democrats in terms of opposing it. But I think we obviously have to read subtext into this. And the fact that the Democrats now are moving towards, and Al Franken has done this, seem to be moving towards embracing health care reform, especially the single payer.
Which is essentially sort of government-guaranteed health insurance.
Government-guaranteed health care, which is where Bernie Sanders is at this point.
And Klobuchar's not there.
Not there yet, but I think that's what's interesting about it. I think she's clearly sort of starting to be, you know, sort of test the waters in terms of, you know, is this where the Democrats want to be, you know, or maybe we're going to find out tomorrow night in the debate, or is she articulating some different themes in contrast to Sanders? But clearly, I think she's trying to figure out a way, if I can read even more subtext into it, you know, in terms of how the Democrats can start to heal that fissure, you know, which has really been between sort of the Clinton versus Sanders people, and Klobuchar was part of the Clinton group at this point. So we have to look at this, I think, beyond just a healthcare debate, but as a debate that's laying out perhaps something in terms of 2018 themes for the Democrats, also in terms of, I think, you know, anticipating the fact that she's coming up for election, although I think it'd be a surprise if she were in serious danger. But then, of course, how it cements the Democratic Party together, and if she's still looking at a national position at some point, this doesn't hurt her in terms of the highlighting of her on CNN on national television.
Yeah, I think it has to be interpreted as her positioning herself for a national run.
I do
because I don't think she is going to stand up there. But well, Cassidy and Graham, obviously, they wrote the bill together, so they're going to be saying the same thing.
Right.
I think she's going to differentiate herself from Bernie Sanders. Obviously, they are on the same side of the aisle, but I think there are differences there. She is not advocating, and has not, to this
right.
point, a single-payer or government-guaranteed health care for all. She hasn't been there. She's positioned herself throughout her career as more of a moderate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a big night for her.
I do, too. That's why I'm saying is I think what will be fascinating is to see how she differentiates versus, again, how much she's looking at the fact that, again, there's a lot of people out there within the Democratic Party, you know, who are moving towards, again, embracing single payer, who are sort of trying to move the Democratic Party further to the left on a variety of issues, which is where Bernie Sanders is, and again, to see how she differentiates herself. And again, if we think of it at this point also, if in fact she's thinking of running in 2020 or being a vice presidential candidate in 2020, we all know, you know, Sanders at this point has all but declared that he's going to run in 2020. So there could be some sense in terms of how does she posture herself in terms of either an alternative to Sanders or, I'll throw it out here, as a possible vice presidential candidate if Bernie Sanders were to be the presidential candidate.
Wow. Okay. That would be interesting. I think that there's enough of a difference there.
Yes, I do too.
And it's going to be interesting. And I also think that she'll be the only woman
mm-hmm.
on the stage. She has often told the story about one of the things that led her into political activism was the very difficult birth of her daughter and being mm-hmm. Kicked out of the hospital and, you know, a day. And I expect stories like that.
Yep.
And I expect her to channel what I think has made her so popular here is that I think she is obviously somebody who's very, very smart, but she also has an ability when she's really on, which is, you know, most of the time she has a way of making herself seem or make – appearing extremely accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's something that she can do pretty well. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how she does. And it'll be really interesting to see the reactions here. I don't think this debate has quite the momentum that it did on Thursday when it was first announced, when it really wasn't clear about where the votes were.
Right.
But it's going to be interesting. I'll be watching.
Well, I think we'll all be watching at this point, and I think that's what Amy Klobuchar is hoping at this point, as well, as well as the Democratic Party.
All right. Listen, folks, we have to take a break. Chatting with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. We're going to, after the weather break, we're going to talk about some really interesting situations. Mediation collapses between the Democratic governor, Republican legislators, and also part of the healthcare debate as well. This whole issue of this waiver that we might not get from the president, it's a complicated issue, but it could have some very real impact on a lot of people very, very soon. So that's coming up with David Schultz. Keep it right here. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It's 8:36 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with Professor David Schultz. We do want to get to some state issues, including this problem that it could occur because the Trump administration is not granting a waiver that the state thought it was going to get. Complicated situation. The impact is going to be significant for many, many people. But before that, let's talk about North Korea. How surprised were you by the president's speech before the United Nations?
I was very surprised by that one. That I, you know, that even though I have never been surprised in the last year and a half, we've been talking about Donald Trump, you know, that on a different level, this one did surprise me because I didn't expect him to take that bellicose or that belligerent approach where he just came out and basically said, you know, he'll destroy North Korea. And you don't usually expect that, you know, at the United Nations. You don't expect that kind of a tenor in language. And so even for Trump, that did sort of push me in a direction where I was kind of surprising. And it's really just sort of escalating the rhetoric, and I think it's escalating the chances that something bad could happen at this point, because we now have North Korea threatening what? A detonation of a hydrogen bomb in the Pacific Ocean. We had today U.S. military flying basically reconnaissance or flying its planes at the northern edge of the North Korean demilitarized zone. I mean, the rhetoric is now starting to be escalated with not just more rhetoric, but with actual actions. And at some point, I think we could potentially tail out of control. And I was hoping that the UN speech would have been a way of maybe, you know, saying, let's give sanctions a chance, let's ratchet this down. It doesn't seem to be ratcheting down. And I was going to draw a connection here. It is that propensity for Trump to want to respond Kim Jong in the same way that he responded to what at the top of our story here to Steph Curry and others.
Right.
He doesn't seem to want to sort of just let things go as a way of de-escalating. He wants to keep escalating
right.
things.
Right. And again, the use of the term "rocket man."
Yes.
In that forum, I mean, it's sort of one thing on Twitter, but I was surprised that he used that term, which he used on Twitter before the United Nations.
Yes, I mean, again, demonstrating, I think, significant lack of respect, you know, for a foreign leader. And whether we like him or not, he is the leader of another sovereign country. And generally, diplomatically, you don't sort of call people derogatory names, especially if you're trying to work problems out or trying to be diplomatic. That's the kind of stuff that happens, you know, when problems, again, problems start to escalate off into exactly where we're going now. Now, whether or not we're going to escalate off into a military campaign or war or something, I have no idea. But I wouldn't say that. But I would say that after today, with us now flying planes right along the edge of the demilitarized zone, that you know North Korea is not going to sort of back down, and they're going to take a next step also.
Right. And I must say, I've been ever since last Sunday when he first tweeted the Rocket Man. I have been playing that Elton John song in my head over and over. But anyway, that's one crazy little aside. I mean, last Sunday morning, I was just going, I can't get this song out of my head anyway.
Okay, so here becomes a great side question here. Do you think sales of that song have gone up?
I bet they have. Or the downloads, I would not be surprised. Let me see if I can find that out.
All right.
But let me ask you, shifting gears here, sort of back to the healthcare issue. Minnesota is suddenly facing a crisis in the healthcare situation that's going to come up very, very quickly. The Republican legislature approved a fix, this reinsurance program, which puts all these high-risk people into one pool. And the result was going to be, when they announced the premiums in just really it's under 2 weeks now, October 2nd, that there was going to be, in some cases, a decrease in premiums. And the premiums increases were at minimum going to be lower. Without that waiver, and apparently there could be 20% higher.
Mm-hmm.
And also, and this just came to light, the governor held a news conference and was extremely sort of frustrated and upset about it. In addition to that, so you've got all the people who are going to face higher premiums and these are the people who are buying on the single market, in the individual marketplace.
Right. The fix to help those individuals was a fix by the Republican legislature.
Right, right. So, and now not only is that in jeopardy, so that's about 169,000 people who get their insurance. They're, you know, self-employed, mostly farmers. They are facing potentially drastically higher healthcare premiums without this waiver. And also, there is suddenly going to be this dramatic cut to Minnesota Care, which could eliminate entirely programs that serve 100,000 people who are essentially the working poor.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this came to light a week ago, apparently. This is a big deal, and the governor seemed to be almost beside himself at this news conference earlier this week, saying, I can't even get Tom Price, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, to return my phone call. What do you think is going to happen here? I mean, Congressman Eric Paulson has weighed in, who's a Republican, saying this is we've got to get this waiver. We can't have these cuts to MnCare. So Republicans are trying to help here. Senator Franken has got Senator Lamar Alexander, a very powerful Republican, to try and intervene with the Health and Human Services Department in Washington. So far, there hasn't been a breakthrough.
There's not, and that's going to be a good question. Is it going to happen in the next 2 weeks, which is basically the start of the new federal budget year? And also, it has to happen as the state of Minnesota, you're right, is starting to announce the new rates, starting to announce the new open enrollment period and so forth. First off, it's very, very unusual for states not to get waivers in terms of, especially in health care. I think under the Obama administration, and I'm going to say even back under the Bush administration, go back to Clinton, that generally the federal government will give states waivers on a variety of things if they can sort of show that what they're doing is an alternative way of getting to some point in terms of whether it's health care or the environment, whatever it may be. So it's first unusual not to get those waivers. Two, it's highly unusual if you're not going to get that waiver for it to be sort of suddenly announced just like a couple of weeks in advance. Usually this stuff is something that is negotiated for months and months and months. And then on top of which, again, the cuts now we're also talking about, again, these are also things that the state usually has an opportunity to sort of, plan for. But here the state is completely being caught by surprise. This is where I think the national health care debate over Obamacare comes into collision with state public policy. At the same time, we know that the Trump administration has said that, even if Obamacare isn't repealed, they're not going to do a lot to sort of help it. So put all these kind of issues together, and which are kind of converging, the state of Minnesota faces a significant problem. And
Unless this waiver is granted, and they are connected. It's very complicated.
It's very complicated, and there's still no guarantee that the waiver will occur, although I would be surprised if it doesn't happen. But we're still sort of pushing it up very close to a deadline, which could still affect at least the initial announcements about the about rates for the year and enrollment. But what I'm getting at also here is think about for the last couple of years, state of Minnesota has talked about having budget surpluses. If all of this were to happen and collide, we're looking at the state of Minnesota having, I'm going to guess, either to have to make billions of dollars in cuts or figure out how to raise billions of additional dollars to pay for all of this. And this suddenly now makes either a special session perhaps required, or it's going to make the next legislative session more interesting, which then connects us to the next issue we're going to talk about.
Right, which is the complete breakdown of the mediation. And I guess we probably should take our final break here, and then we can talk about that on the back end, because I'm personally not surprised that the mediation broke down because they couldn't come to agreement for months. But
That's right.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, This breakdown of mediation, what comes next? I think some of the legislative funding ends on October 1st. October 1st is really soon. Keep it here, folks. News Radio 830. Nice job, Kevin Reed, pulling out the rocket man. David Schultz, this is the song that I couldn't help but think about.
Yes.
All right, folks, before we get into our next conversation, it is... Our time check is 848, certified McCarthy's Cadillacs, now up to 40% off MSRP. Shop McCarthyAuto.com. That's McCarthyAuto.com. All right, and that is Rocket Man. All right, Professor David Schultz. It's a great song.
It's a wonderful song, although I still prefer Captain Tom by Bowie myself, but still a good song.
Absolutely. All right. Mediation breaks down between the governor and the legislative leaders. They had been ordered into mediation by the Minnesota Supreme Court. I'm not surprised it broke down.
I'm not either. I think anybody who thought that they were going to be able to reconcile their differences had to be pretty naive. Now, I think the Minnesota Supreme Court was hoping, beyond hope, that they would be able to mediate and work out their disagreements, because at the end of the day, the Minnesota Supreme Court does not want to decide this case. But guess what? The case is back before them, and they may be forced to have to resolve this matter in terms of the funding issue and eventually resolving the question regarding really ultimately how you draw the line between the constitutionality of the governor's line item veto versus the right of the legislature to be functioning and staying in business. The court punted on that question. I think they're going to have to address that question.
So that's my question to you. Does this mean automatically that it goes back before the Minnesota Supreme Court?
And that's not completely clear at this point either. Now, the court never overturned the district court opinion rendered in Ramsey County Court, so it doesn't look like it's going to go back there. Does this mean now it goes up back to the Minnesota Supreme Court? And if so, what are they going to rule on? Are they going to be ruling on the issue regarding temporary funding for the legislature to get them until they go to, until they come back in session in February? Or are they going to rule on the issue of the constitutionality of the governor's line item veto? That's not clear at this point. And so I will be curious to find out after the two parties report back, the governor and legislature, to the Supreme Court. What will occur is, assuming they're going to take the case, it'll be the briefing orders. And what I mean by that, they'll be directing the governor and the legislature to brief something, unless, and again, this is why I'm raising lots of questions, because I'm not completely sure, unless the court's now prepared to say that based upon the briefs and arguments we've already heard, we're going to decide the case. I think there's just lots of questions here, exactly what the next step is. But it does suggest that the next move is up to the Minnesota Supreme Court.
But some of the funding here, it runs out October 1st.
Exactly. And this is part of what's at a dispute here, is because the governor is claiming and saying that, well, there's still enough funding for you folks to be able to stay in existence until come back in session in February. Legislature is coming back and saying two things. First, there may or may not be enough funding, but B, that's not the issue. They're saying it's the issue, the fact that you try to, you know, zero us out and to try to force us to do something by and change the laws on tax cuts that you didn't like by basically putting us out of business. And so, depending on
court say that part of it was unconstitutional?
Yes, the lower court did. Ramsey County Court did say that, and that's the part that the Minnesota Supreme Court didn't explicitly overturn. And that's why I find what the Minnesota Supreme Court did a couple of weeks ago when it said go to mediation to be somewhat confusing to start with, and again, maybe naive or maybe they were hopeful that something would happen. But now that the governor and legislature have said we have an impasse, and the mediator has agreed, by the way, that's the important point. The mediator has also agreed, a retired state judge. I don't know exactly what the Supreme Court's going to do, because you're right. We're going to have some funding run out on October 1st. Potentially, we could start to see some staffers and some of the people at the legislature start to get furlough notices very soon. We're in sort of, I think, both political and legal limbo right now, and I'm not exactly sure, you know, where all this takes us.
Right. You know, at one point, I think in Speaker Dowd's news conference, he actually went back and read a text that was 4 months old. I mean, that there had been agreement on the tax bill. So there seems to be, there just doesn't seem any way they're going to agree on anything. And somebody's got to make a ruling. Let me ask you why, and you explained, I think on our last show, the difference between mediation and arbitration. And mediation is when the two sides get together and try and work it out with the help of a third party. Arbitration is where that happens, but the arbitrator actually decides. Why didn't the Supreme Court just order them into arbitration, or could they have done that?
Well, first off, I'm not even sure the Minnesota Supreme Court has the constitutional authority to order them into mediation.
But they did.
They did. So that's a good question to start with. But now it's arbitration. I don't know if they have the authority to do that, because what they'd be saying is that we're going to take two constitutional offices or bodies, the executive branch, and the governor, and the legislature, and now have a third party who's not part of the court system basically listen to two sides and make a final decision. I'm just not sure that is constitutional in and of itself. If the Minnesota Supreme Court doesn't want to resolve this dispute, and questions whether or not it has the legal authority to do so. It's certainly the case that an outside arbitrator would not have that authority to do it.
You know, and one thing that hasn't gotten like a ton of attention is the cost of all this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Dayton's office has been billed $245,000 in legal fees over this. You have to imagine that the legislature, I mean, these are top-rung attorneys that are actually discounting their rates. Mm-hmm. You have to imagine that it's got to be another $245,000 for the legislative side. That's $500,000 at least, at minimum.
At a minimum, and I suspect it's going to only escalate now. And then throw in the fact that, you know, if this is going to drag out for a few more months here, again, think about some partial layoffs or what doesn't get done. This is kind of like when we had the government shutdown a few years ago. And I think we talked about this once. I did some calculations. It would have been cheaper for the government to keep the lights on and just keep going at, keep doing something as opposed to the cost of shutting down, being shut down and restarting. And it's the same thing here is that we're generating the litigation costs, the cost of potentially shutting down part of the legislature for a while. And again, for people who don't understand or haven't paid attention to this, this is coming out of the taxpayers' pockets.
Right. And I think at some point there's going to be some sort of outrage over that. So you think it goes back to the Minnesota Supreme Court and they'll have to make some kind of decision here?
They do. And again, exactly what the decision is going to be, I don't know, because one possibility is for them to say, we do have the authority to order funding and we're going to fund the legislature until they come back into session in February. That would be the most minimal decision, I think, possible. A second one is for them to, and that doesn't really resolve the dispute, doesn't resolve the underlying dispute about the constitutionality of the line item veto. A different stage would be to actually address that issue. And that's where I don't know where the court's going to go. Is it going to go look just at the funding issue and just say, let's do enough to keep the legislature going for another, 3 months or 4 months? Or does it go even further? And now bring us back to the earlier story. What if the Trump administration doesn't give the legislature or doesn't give the state the waivers that it needs? My suspicion is you're going to have to bring the legislature back.
I mean, that's going to be a bona fide crisis.
It's going to be. And there's no way that you can let that one sit until, February?
Right.
February something this year when they're or next year come back in session? You're not going to let that
that's
one sit
point.
At that point. So it's a crisis.
Right. Because, I mean, that you're talking about premiums that affect 160,000 people who are buying on the individual market. And then you've got 100,000 other people who are getting these benefits and health care through Minnesota Care that will be losing the benefits. I mean, that is a total of 250,000 people who are going to be drastically affected. And that, I think, is politically untenable on either side. So
right.
that is an interesting point. Well, we'll have to see what happens with that, because that is a continued mess,
yes,
to
yes.
say the least. All right. Well, listen, Professor David Schultz, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. And we'll see you next week. Goodness knows what's going to be going on by then.
Who knows? Well, it's always a new story.
All right. Thank you so much. The one and only David Schultz. And I encourage you folks who enjoy listening to him to check out his blog, Schultz's Take. It is always good, always informative, always insightful. Well, listen, it's been great to be on this Saturday evening. I want to thank the producer of this show, Susan Blanche. She always does a terrific job. She also is the producer for Jordana and, of course, Paul Douglas. So she's a very busy lady these days. So I want to thank her, and also want to thank the studio coordinator, Kevin Reed. I want to invite you to tune in to WCCO-TV Sunday morning tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., 10:30 a.m. On the 10:30 a.m. show, we will have stock market guru Pete Najarian and also Congressman Eric Paulson.
The results are in. Great conversations are always on par. So follow and listen to On Par with me, Maury Povich, wherever you get your podcasts.